Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet. Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, April 15th, 2014, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. As you may have heard, our beloved Velva Bloomer made her transition off the planet on April 3rd, 2014, and our show tonight is dedicated to the celebration of her life and endless service to the planet. Lavendar and I recorded her stories of adventure with Velva a few days ago, not knowing that at that exact time, there were memorial services being held for Velva in Colorado and Utah. There wouldn't be a Starseed hotline or radio show if it weren't for Velva's entrance into Lavendar's life, leading her to the galactic training that we pass on to you. There has been a memorial fund started to help her family buy a headstone for Velva. And if you'd like to thank Velva for the work she's done for the planet, any contribution will help. You can use PayPal to send it to lynnbangs@hotmail.com. That's Lynn, L-Y-N-N, Bangs, B-A-N-G-S, at hotmail.com, or you can contact Lynn at that email address. Velva also has a Facebook page where you can add your voice to others in appreciation of such a galactic treasure. At the top of the show, it's the Starseed News segment with Anastasia, bringing topics of interest to Starseed and sharing some emails from our listeners. We'd like to thank Fiona and Vanya tonight for hosting the switchboard, although we won't be having questions at the end of our presentation. You can still call in to listen on 917-889-8292. We have an online community at starseedhotline.ning.com, and we'd like to thank Tammy for her help and dedication to the forum. Starseed Hotline's toll-free number is 888-881-0881. The Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings in your natal astrological chart, and the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. Remote healing sessions for people and pets are also available with Tammy. And if you have a birthday coming up, you can find out how to make the most of your 10 hours of power by requesting your solar return timing. And I'd like to introduce Anastasia first this evening. So, Anastasia, hello.
Well, hi, Arielle. How is everybody tonight?
We are
doing...
Can
you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Good. Well, we're good to go then. It's great to be back. The weeks fly by, and here we are again. And I want to say that it's really a special evening to honor Velva and Lavendar together, quite the pair. It's going to be a very special show, and she will be missed. And we're going to start tonight's news as we normally do. We're going to start this with news from spaceweather.com. There has been a new moon, they think, and they've named her Peggy. NASA's Cassini spacecraft have photographed a small icy object forming at the edge of Saturn's rings. I saw a photo of that on the Internet, and to me, it just looks like a bright spot. But to experts, they say that it is a collection of ice formations, probably the beginning of a new moon for Saturn, forming around the outer edge of the rings. They named it Peggy after a woman that was connected to the person who discovered it, and they think that it is a brand new moon being born. If you want to find out more about that, you can go to Science at NASA. And today, there was a total lunar eclipse, and Space Weather says that all of the sunrises and sunsets on Earth got together and painted the moon red. Now, in the apocalyptic world of religious people, they claim that this was a sign of the end of the world. But NASA and the space experts are telling us that the moon turned red during the transit because the core of our planet's shadow is red. And there's a fast-growing sunspot now. Just not even hardly 24 hours ago, sunspot AR 2036 didn't even exist. And they say that now it's three times as wide as Earth. Now, this new Sunspot has a beta gamma magnetic field that harbors energy for M-class solar flares. They will be Earth-directed because the sunspot is almost directly facing our planet. They say the region's rapid rotation could destabilize the field, making an eruption even more likely. And they say that sometime today they estimate a 35% chance of M flares and a 5% chance of X-class flares. So a lot happens in 24 hours. And speaking of that, it's been springtime where I live. In 24 hours, amazing things have happened. Dandelions have popped up and violets and beautiful trees in bloom. And just in a very short period of time, we're seeing signs of spring. It's a lovely thing. It's wonderful. I know you're all celebrating that as well. However, we did have a cold spell with a brief skiff of snow today. Nevertheless, the insects are out, the bees and so on. So it's really good to say goodbye to winter. Well, the big news in the internet world last week was that experts had found a door ajar in an internet security method that everybody thought was safe. They say that a flaw was discovered in the Internet's key security HTTPS or OpenSSL protocol. I'm sure many of you have heard about that. And the most immediate advice from security experts to consumers is to wait or at least be cautious before changing your passwords. This bug on the Internet security protocol actually had existed for 2 years up until it was discovered by a group of Finnish researchers and security researchers at Google. Now, this is something that has really compromised everybody who uses secure sites on the Internet. When you have that little padlock in the upper corner of your browser that indicates that it's a secure connection from you to the next server or the person that you're trying to contact, this is where the holes in this security occurred. By the way, the latest news of this is that the NSA and other government agencies were aware of this security breach and utilized it for their own purposes without informing the public. Now, they say that by now, and this has been just about a week, I guess, they say that many of the major companies, internet companies, have produced patches and fixes. Google and Facebook and, goodness, PayPal, certainly. All of those big secure sites have taken measures to fix that immediately when it was revealed. This, by the way, is called the heartbleed bug, because they say that the OpenSSL protocol, and again, that's the thing that encrypts the sessions between you and websites, is called the heartbeat. The ping that messages back and forth between computer and server is called the heartbeat, so they named this bug the heartbleed. And so what they're advising people to do is to change your passwords and also make sure that the companies that you are working with have addressed the issue. Smaller companies have not yet addressed it. Major companies have. And so if you have need for any more information on that, you can Google heartbleed to find out more about it. And that really is unfortunate to think that for 2 years people were having their data exposed without any clue of what was going on. Very unfortunate. Well, this has been a week for earthquakes all across the planet. I'll tell you, there was a 6.9 earthquake in Africa that occurred just yesterday. Also on yesterday, there was a 4.6 earthquake in Chalice, a 5.9 earthquake near Kirakira. These are all off, I think, the African continent. So there's been a lot going on. And a third earthquake had stricken Nicaragua in less than a week. This was early yesterday morning. The third earthquake hit Nicaragua that shook buildings in Managua, which is the capital. And although there were no immediate reports of damage, the quake was of 5.6. But earthquakes earlier on Thursday and Friday of last week were 6.1 and a magnitude 6.6, respectively. So, and then there were also strong earthquakes April 10th in Nicaragua. There was a magnitude 6.1, and on March 2nd, a 6.4. So it's been a very active region. And as a matter of fact, in response to this, the authorities in Nicaragua have put the entire country on an extreme red alert, the highest possible, because they're really concerned about this subsequent repeated tremors that they've been having. Nicaraguans have been asked to sleep outdoors, as seismologists have warned of the possibility of a powerful earthquake rocking this country in Central America. They say that the recent tremors had reactivated a fault, the one that caused that really devastating earthquake in 1972.
Wow.
And so that is what's going on. Now, in Chile, they've also had a bunch of earthquakes, quite a few. Last Thursday, there was a 6.0 in Iquique, Chile. I hope I said that right. And in the Solomon Islands, this was just a couple days ago, there was a 7.6 magnitude quake and a reported 7.4 quake. It struck off the coast of the Solomon Islands. It was on Sunday, actually. And these quakes were only 16 hours apart from one another. Now, according to the USGS, there have been 29 aftershocks in the Solomon Islands, and the population of that little area is about 600,000 people. And it was already reeling from the devastating flash floods that struck a city in that region on April 3rd. So the floods left 9,000 people homeless. Now they're having these big earthquakes. And it's really tough for them. The articles indicate the people are really kind of highly stressed. The Solomon Islands, of course, lies on the Ring of Fire, which is an arc of earthquake and volcanic activity that stretches, as you know, all the way around the Pacific Rim. And in Idaho, there was a 4.9 earthquake on Saturday, the 12th of April. And in Papua New Guinea on Friday, also a 7.1 magnitude earthquake. And there was an aftershock to that one, and that was a magnitude 6.5 that occurred on the same day, a little bit later. And in Peru, the Ubinas volcano has erupted. There's a huge volcanic eruption going on in Peru right now. They say that sending a giant plume of smoke and ash way up into the sky. It's the Ubinas volcano. It's high in the Andes. They say that it's been an active volcano, but major eruptions have been going on since maybe 2006. Authorities are advising people to plan for emergency evacuations should the situation get worse. So just a lot going on. You know, there was so much news to report for tonight's show that I just had to not report all of it. There's just so much going on in the way of earth changes and stuff happening. Well, closer to home, I want to talk a little bit about Albuquerque. Albuquerque. Bugs Bunny used to say that. Which way to Albuquerque? Well, we're going to talk about Albuquerque, New Mexico today because something has been happening there that's of concern. The residents of Albuquerque, New Mexico, did march on the police department last Saturday, actually this Saturday, it's past Saturday, to demand retribution against the city's mayor and their police chief for their role in the police force's documented execution of citizens. Now, this protest followed a Department of Justice report that incriminated the Albuquerque Police Department for their use of excessive and lethal force. Now, this Justice Department investigation, which apparently was launched way back in November 2012, discovered that officers too frequently use deadly force against people who pose a minimal threat and in situations where the conduct of the officers heightens and intensifies the danger, and that encounters between the Albuquerque Police Department officers and persons with mental illness and in crisis too frequently result in the use of force or a higher level of force than necessary. Now, there recently was a leaked video taken from a police helmet camera that depicts the Albuquerque Police Department officers killing a man named James Boyd, who was an unarmed homeless man that was wandering out in the desert backcountry. So there was a quite extensive bit of material on that. I'm giving you the brief overview. But those of you that live in New Mexico, I thought you might need to know this bit of information. And in Jackson, Wyoming, there has been another hillside collapsing. Actually, this is the first one in Wyoming. Of course, we've had some recently. But they say that local officials and dozens of people kept watch over their property last Thursday while a slowly sliding hillside threatened to take out homes and businesses in that little resort town. It's very pretty. Jackson, Wyoming's beautiful. They say that the last I heard, now this was over the weekend, people were still remaining evacuated, and there were 46 houses and apartment units that had been emptied because of this threatened moving hillside. So I hadn't heard any more about that. Any Starseed living in that area that have any information, give me an email, let me know. I'd like to hear about it. Well, the Atlantic bottlenose dolphin death toll actually topped over 1,200, they say, between July 2013 and April 2014, this year, this month. They say it's nearly seven times the normal rate. Now, the bottlenose dolphin die-off, according to NOAA Fisheries, has risen, and they say that the death toll is 62% higher than during the last major die-off in 1987 to 1988, and it is 6.7 times higher than the 2007 to 2012 norm. So they don't know what's going on. They just know that something's happening to these dolphins in the Atlantic. And over the last few months, I've been reporting a few stories about this, dolphins here and dolphins there. And this is just a report put out by the NOAA Fisheries. And if you might recall, as we've talked about meteors and fireballs in the past, I've mentioned that noctilucent clouds generally increase from meteoric dust. And there was an article in a website called Red Orbit about this, and they say that, and I'd never heard this before, you guys, but NASA had developed a mission that they called Aeronomy of Ice, Aeronomy of Ice in the Mesosphere, or they call it AIM for short. You have to have an acronym if you're going to be a government agency. So AIM was launched in 2007 in order to observe noctilucent clouds. Well, now scientists have gathered information from several other missions, past and present. They put it together with some computer simulations to show that the presence of these bright, shining clouds have indeed increased in areas between 40 and 50 degrees north latitude, and that's the region that covers the northern third of the United States and the lowest parts of Canada. Now, they say that noctilucent clouds occur at 50 miles above the Earth, but AIM and other research has shown that in order for clouds to form, three things are needed. We need very cold temperatures, which we've had, water vapor, and meteor dust. So it is possible then that the meteors that have been incoming, all of these fireballs we've seen, have had a strong contribution to the noctilucent clouds. And if you see those on the internet, it's a very amazing thing in a dark sky to see these shimmering clouds at night. It's really kind of beautiful. And Tatooine, the home of Star Wars. I can't say that. You guys want to know how to pronounce that, you have to watch Star Wars again because I can't say it. But it's in Tunisia. They've had their second meteorite landing. This time it happened just last week and caused an enormous bang. I guess it was quite the reverberation. They say it hit the town of Ramada, located in Tatooine. And at the moment, scientists don't know where the meteorite came from, but they're continuing their research. So for the second time in about 6 months, the home of Star Wars has been stricken by an incoming meteor. And in Russia, we're going to talk about something besides war and conflict. We're going to talk about conflict of a different kind tonight. The Russian Prime Minister has declared that Russia will not import GMO products. He said that the nation has enough space and resources to produce organic food. Well, good for you, Russia. And by the way, everybody, this is from Starseed Chris. Thank you, Chris. And I got to thank it. Remind me to thank everybody before I get off tonight. I had a whole bunch of people to mention. But anyway, the Russian Prime Minister said that if the Americans like to eat GMO products, let them eat it then. We don't need to do that. We have enough space and opportunities to produce organic food. The Prime Minister said he ordered widespread monitoring of the agricultural sector, and he added that despite rather strict restrictions, a certain amount of GMO products and seeds have made it to the Russian market. Now, not only the Prime Minister, but the Agriculture Minister of Russia also stated that their country should remain free of genetically modified products. And at the end of February this year, the Russian Parliament asked the government to impose a temporary ban on all genetically altered products in Russia. They felt that until they understand the effects of GMOs on humans and the natural environment, the government should impose a moratorium on the breeding and growth of genetically modified plants, animals, and microorganisms. Isn't that something?
It sure says a whole lot.
Yeah. That's just, you know, you don't even need to comment on that, really. Here we are in America, and we're choking on GMOs, and in Russia, they're being looked after. That's really cool, though. And this is from one of our Starseed listeners, and I want to apologize right now because, you know what, I think I accidentally erased her name from this. She'll know it when she hears the article. I want to thank, by the way, the usual suspects in this broadcast where we talk about the news. We've just had so much help from all of the people that constantly give me articles. We have Emily and Barbara and, oh my gosh, on and on. I love you all. And anyway, I think this is from Barbara, but I'm not sure. Anyway, this is an article about DNA being injected with nanorobots. And these are called, well, this particular robot is called an origami robot. And they can deliver drugs into the body. Ah, that's just really wild. I didn't even know that. And they say that now researchers have implanted cockroaches with these nanorobots that have fluorescent markers. Now, the fluorescent markers in these little bots allow researchers to see where in the body these little robots are traveling. And New Scientist magazine reports that the accuracy of delivery and control of the nanobots is equivalent to a computer system. Yikes!
Uh-oh.
The nanobots can interact with one another and were shown to be able to perform simple logical operations, for example, releasing a molecule stored within upon command. Upon command. Wow, point and click, and the nanobot inside of a cockroach body does what you want it to do. Now, this is the first time that biological therapy has been able to match how a computer processor works, one of these researchers said. By the way, he was from the Institute of Nanotechnology and Advanced Materials at Bar Ilan University in Israel. Now, the scientist said that it should be possible to improve the computing power of the nanobots to approach that of an 8-bit computer, which is equivalent to, if you'll remember, a Commodore 64 or Atari 800 from the 1980s. Now, they say that while the bots cannot currently be inserted into mammals due to their more advanced immune systems that can recognize and target these bots as foreign particles, thank goodness, he said they can probably be modified to do that anyway. He said there is no reason why preliminary trials on humans can't start within 5 years. Yikes. Oh, boy. Beat me up, Scotty.
We all have something to focus on, and we all have something to send the energy of cancellation to that.
Absolutely. You go, girl. We're all going to do. Let's all focus on that one, okay? That's deserving
cancel.
Of our neutralization for sure. Well, in Australia, there was a cyclone. I don't know if anybody's heard about that. The news is a little bit old. It's since been downgraded to a tropical storm. But Australian starseed Emily sent me that information. And I guess that was a pretty bad cyclone. Said it had winds of 230 kilometers an hour. They said it was one of the most powerful storms to hit in living memory. They called it a Category 4 cyclone. It's since been downgraded to a tropical storm. So, you know, I think it's pretty much over. But Australia's had a really tough time of it in the last year or so with their weather and incidents, fires and snow and all kinds of stuff. And I want to conclude tonight's story with something that I think is really important for everybody to know. And you remember the Flintstones, don't you, Ariel? Lavender,
yes,
you guys remember the Flintstones? Yeah, yabba dabba do. Well, they're cool cartoons for kids. It was really cool. And you know, it makes pretty cute cutouts for vitamins. And we, you know, the Flintstones vitamins, they're so cute. They look like little Flintstones characters. And we would expect vitamins to be good for the body, particularly for our children's body, since it's kids' vitamins, but not so fast. According to an article in Collective Evolution, the Flintstones vitamins for kids contains all kinds of bad stuff. Aspartame, for one. Aspartame is known to damage the brain at any dose by leaving traces of methanol in the blood. It's also linked to lymphoma and leukemia and on and on and on. And you probably all know about the detriments of aspartame. It could go on and on. And also, these cute little cartoon vitamins have sorbitol. Well, sorbitol is a synthetic sugar. It's a sugar substitute. It's classified as a sugar alcohol. And the ingestion of higher amounts of sorbitol have been linked to gastrointestinal disturbances from abdominal pain to irritable bowel syndrome. Oh, what else is in Flintstone's vitamins? Well, there's hydrogenated soybean oil. And these are semi-synthetic fatty acids that incorporate themselves right into our tissues. They've been linked to dozens of harmful health effects, from coronary artery disease to fatty liver disease to other unmentionable things. And they also contain ferrous fumarate. Now, this is an amazing thing, because if you know anything about iron intake in the body, this makes you go, what? It's really remarkable that they put that in vitamins because, and even, as a matter of fact, according to this article, there's a clear warning on the Flintstones website concerning this chemical. They say that when consuming iron that comes naturally in food, it's impossible to inject toxic amounts that can cause death, but when you take ferrous fumarate, fatal levels of toxicity can be reached. I guess this is from the website. I'm taking this off the article. It says, accidental overdose of iron-containing products is a leading cause of fatal poisoning in children under six. Keep this product out of the reach of children. In case of accidental overdose, call a poison control center. So that is in the kids' vitamins. Also, cupric oxide. Well, according to the European Union's Dangerous Substance Directive, cupric oxide is listed as a hazardous substance. They say that it's dangerous to both people and to the environment. It's used as a pigment in ceramics and is a chemical in the production of rayon fabric, and it's used in dry cell batteries. And it's also in the Flintstones vitamins. Well, Bayer is a pharmaceutical company, and it's the developer of Flintstone vitamins. That doesn't necessarily, according to this article and other sites that I've read, have the best track record. Bayer is a German chemical and pharmaceutical company founded in 1863. In 1925, it became a part of IG Farben, and that is a German chemical industry conglomerate. So might want to be aware of what's in Flintstone vitamins. In fact, we should always be reading labels. Don't you agree, Daria?
We
should read them very carefully and know what those ingredients are.
It's imperative.
It's imperative, yes, it is.
You have
buyer beware. That's right, exactly. And just because it has a pretty picture on the box or it looks healthy doesn't mean it is. And I remember about, 15 years ago, I had the blessing of visiting with a doctor, a medical doctor that was trained in Mexico. And now this was when I lived in the American Southwest. And I was taking her advice for some time on diet and different things. She was a wonderful woman, very sensible, very natural in her approach. And she trained me to eat well, and she's the one that taught me really a lot about what I know. And she got me to the point where I went into the grocery store. I felt like I was walking into some kind of toxic bucket. As I looked around at everything in the store, all of the packaging, and there are so many things. When you're aware of the food that you should be eating, you become acutely aware of the things you shouldn't be eating. And so I think sometimes simpler is better. What's wrong with getting our vitamins from nice, nutritious food?
And, if the food is grown in healthy soil, that works.
Right.
But when the soil is depleted, the nutrient levels are sorely lacking.
There are good
sources for vitamin supplementation from natural synthetic vitamins.
Not chemicals.
Look.
Right.
Right.
That's right. Well, I think that'll do it for tonight's news. But did you say something, Lavendar? Did I hear you? No, I'm hearing things.
She's about to come on, but...
Okay, she's not on yet. Okay.
No, not yet.
Okay. So anyway, I'm looking forward to the show, and I just want to give all the Starseed my love, and thank you all for sending in all these wonderful pieces that you're contributing. Oh, by the way, let me just tell you one more thing. Barbara, one of our Starseed listeners, sent me a wonderful article. I'm going to tell you two sentences, and that is that a spice, curcurum, turmeric, you've heard of that, Ariel, I'm sure.
Yes.
This article indicates that a turmeric prevents fluoride from hurting your brain. And they say that curcumin attenuates neurotoxicity induced by fluoride. And there are studies that are showing that. There's a Pharmacognosy magazine. Look, you can't even begin to pronounce that, but you can look that up on the Internet if you want to Google it, about curcumin stopping the bad effects of fluoride, which we talked about last week with the pineal gland and so forth. So might want to increase your turmeric intake if you are drinking water that's got fluoride in it. I just wanted to pass that along. Okay, that'll do it for tonight.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Anastasia. And I'm going to bring Lavender on just for a quick moment here, but we are going to get to our celebration of Belva in just a moment. But Lavender, are you with us?
Yes, I wanted to thank everyone that has sent me an email concerning Belva, and I really do appreciate the heartfelt expressions of sympathy that have been given to me and that continue to come since we put out the announcement. So I just wanted to thank everybody for their well wishes.
Well, we are going to play a recording now that Lavendar and I did a few days ago to honor and celebrate the life of Belva Bloomer. Tonight we are honoring the life and work of our beloved sister, Belva Bloomer, who left this planet on April 3rd, 2014. And Belva was actually the catalyst that happened 38 years ago, not only for Lavendar's work, but for my meeting with Lavendar, and ultimately the creation of Starseed Hotline and this radio show. So that's how far back it tracks. So, Lavendar, tell us about your time with Belva.
I had so many adventures with Belva, and I think of Belva as my galactic mother, my galactic godmother. And when I first met her, it was in 1976. I went to Las Vegas. I had been a student of the Academy of Atlantis in Santa Monica. I was now an astrologer, and Chris Well and Peter Herkus were doing a show at the Hilton, and they asked me to join them on stage. And I had never done anything quite like that before, so at that time I was doing psychometry, where I'd hold an object and talk to people about different things. That's when I first discovered that I didn't want to do that anymore, because on stage, when I'd hold rings or bracelets or things of objects of people, I was doing this in front of about 1,000 people, and some of the information was very personal, and I didn't think that that was quite right to do in front of all those people. So I did this for several days there at the Hilton, but when it was over, I knew I would never do it again. They had a psychic fair going on at the Hilton where a lot of psychics came and did readings. And so I had a little booth, and this woman walked up to me, blonde, beautiful, energetic, blue eyes. And she walked up, and the minute I saw her, it was like, wow, who is this woman? Kind of reminded me of Phyllis Dillard in a way. But there was just something about her that just really, it almost shocked me when I saw her. And she said, you're the only one that I want a reading from today. And I said, okay. So as I was starting to have this time with her, there was kind of an energy that came kind of over me. I look back on it now, and I know what it was. It was called a drop-by. I call them drop-bys now instead of walk-ins. There was this energy that kind of came over me, and as I started speaking, I thought, oh, my goodness, something has a hold of my tongue, and I'm just saying things, and I don't know where it's coming from. And what I said to her was, oh, I see a big clock, and I see that you're going to go over with a broom, and you're going to sweep this clock, which says you're taking time away I don't really know what this means. And she goes, well, I know what it means. I'm going in for a facelift tomorrow. And so I said, okay. And so she had her husband, Vernon, with her, and he was next. And so same thing happened with him. I said, oh, you're an artist. I see you doing some paintings, and this painting is going to go all over the world. It's going to go global. Something that you're going to paint is going to go everywhere. I didn't know it then, but Vernon Blumer, he's the one that designed the front cover of my crystal book. And of course, it has now gone all over the world after its ninth printing. So those were the two major things that I remember about the two readings that I had with them. So after she had her facelift, and after I had decided to move to Las Vegas, I contacted her. And she said, I really want to help you. And I have this beauty shop. It's called The Lash. And she said all kinds of people come there, celebrities and high rollers and dealers from the casinos. And she said, I have a little room on the side. And if you'll come and do, you know, your astrology and your readings there, you know, I think that'll be really good. So I said, okay. So for the next 4 years, I had this little office, this little room where she was, and things that would happen in that beauty shop, it was magical every day. And people would come, and they would lay back, and she would start putting eyelashes on them, because she did the lashes, eyelashes, and Vernon would do the fingernails and hair. He did hair. And she would capture these people in her chair, and you know, and she'd spin it in such a way that they would just have to come in and have a reading with me before they left. she was just that good, okay? And so we had so many people come from all over the world in and out of the Lash, and I called it the metaphysical watering hole. And we also had a healer that would come ever so often, and I would give up my room for him, and I would work with him, and his name was Harvey Bevere. And she and Harvey had quite a history, and that's a whole nother story by itself, but he would come and do these healings on people, and I got to see firsthand how he worked, how he would take someone and put them in a chair, do crack, 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 and then this entity would leave. If they were possessed or if they had a negativity attached to them, I was able to see energies leave people's bodies. And so he was teaching me so much about energy at that time. So during this period of time, I started having ET contact. And when it first happened, the first person that I would call would be Belva. In fact, everything that happened for the next 25 years, if it was high strangeness, if it was something that I couldn't tell anybody else, I would pick up the phone and I would call Belva. And I'd say, listen to this. This just happened. And then and she'd be, you know, I'm sure, you know, Vernon told me later, he says, sometimes when you'd call, I'd look over, her eyes would be so big. And then she'd hang up the phone, and then she couldn't even speak. She couldn't even talk. He'd say, you know, you were always calling and saying these wild things, and he said, I never knew what was going on, but I knew it was important. So anyway, through all of this, she became my galactic partner in crime with a lot of activities that happened on the planet. So at this time, I'd just kind of like to talk about some of those encounters. So maybe we should start with the one where she took me to Giant Rock. I think that's the place to go in the meeting of George Van Tassel. She came to me one day and she said, you know, I've had these experiences down at a place called Giant Rock, which is close to Joshua Tree, California. And she would tell me about going out in the desert and how this ET showed up with a fan belt and put it on her car. and then the different stories that she would relate to me about George Van Tassel and his ET contacts. And so I said, okay, I'd kind of like to meet him. So we drove down. We had several trips to Giant Rock. I can think of three or four different trips where we just go and sit and be inside the rock, and then we would go to his house, and we had a lot of fun at Giant Rock. And then there was the day that Close Encounters was premiered in Las Vegas, and George called me and he said, I really want you to be with us. Steven Spielberg came, you know, everyone was there for the premiere of Close Encounters. And Belva, I was sitting next to Belva, and then next to me was George, and then Vernon, and then Doris. And I said, oh, you know, Belva, I said, Mercury's retrograde. She said, oh, that's right. She said, the film's going to break. And I said, yeah, the film's going to break. And we just had this little chuckle about the film breaking. So sure enough, the film starts, and it breaks. And there we were giggling about Mercury being retrograde and Close Encounters premiere.
Would you expound a little bit for those people that don't know about George Van Tassel, the Integratron? And
yes, George Van Tassel, in the early 50s, had a lot of ET contact at Giant Rock. And Giant Rock was a place where underneath a huge rock was this huge room where he and his family lived. And then later it was turned into a restaurant. And there was a little airstrip there where our airplanes would come and land. And a lot of UFO conventions took place there in the early 50s. And Belva and Vernon would go to these conventions and meet people. George Adamski, all of the people that were in the UFO movement in the 50s, you know, came to Giant Rock for these conventions. And George was someone that really was ahead of his time. And he was not afraid to speak of the things that came to him. So he built something called the Integratron. And it was a huge device that he was told would be the rejuvenation chamber. You could walk in, walk out, and it would readjust all the cells in your body. And if you had an illness, it would correct them. And if you didn't have an illness, it would just give you a longer life. So the government, they set up some headquarters up on a hill, and they monitored George and Doris from there. And they tapped their phone lines, and they just kind of made it their business to keep track of what was happening at Giant Rock. So my time with Belva was an extension of my time with George. It's like Belva, George, and I, and Doris, you know, all of it was just part of an experimental high strangeness routine.
When did you go to Giant Rock with Belva the first time? What year?
I believe it was either late 76 or early 77.
So that was just a year or less before you went back and had your crack between the worlds.
Right, right.
Okay, which is, by the way, our feature story that you can hear in the archives, but that took place at Giant Rock, so this is just kind of some background on how that came through Belva.
And also we would have a lot of people that would come through that beauty shop that would be, you know, someone that we would integrate into our life. You know, we had hypnotists and other psychics and just all kinds of metaphysical people walked in and out of our life. And there was a lady named Shirley Rice, and she introduced Belva to the White Brotherhood. And then Belva introduced me to the White Brotherhood. And we used to fly to Denver, Colorado once a month to hear the White Brotherhood messages. And even if I was, you know, somewhere else on the planet, I would get an airplane ticket and I would end up in Denver, Colorado. And did this for many years. But while I was living in Las Vegas, we would go and have these White Brotherhood meetings.
For those that may not know, who is the White Brotherhood?
Well, the White Brotherhood, Dr. Doriel, he had long passed, and he transferred his information to Dr. Trenton Tully, and there was a metaphysical building and school where people would come and study about ancient secrets, ancient texts, things that, you know, that were important for the metaphysical community to know about, and it was called the White Brotherhood.
Okay.
And she became very involved with the White Brotherhood. I too was with the White Brotherhood in training for several years, and then there was a time when it was no longer necessary for me to be a part of it. But she stayed with it. She stayed with it all those years.
So a beauty shop called The Lash. I think I remember you telling me that it was actually Velva and Vernon who invented the individual eyelashes that you glue on.
Right. They had their product in 17 different stores, and she's the one that invented the eyelashes. And Vernon also invented the porcelain fingernails. Yeah. She was an inventor. She did a lot of just awesome things.
Yeah, I remember a story that she told me, and I don't know where this fits into the chronology, but that she learned how to be a race car driver from Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
Did she ever tell you that story?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then you know, later when Steve McQueen died, we went down to Mexico and we rented this cottage, and the lady that rented it to us said, oh, this is where Steve McQueen came to do his alternative healing, and this is where he died. He died here. I'll never forget Belva and I. We looked at each other and went, whoa. Yeah.
Because she didn't know that Belva was friends with him.
No, she didn't know. No.
Oh.
It was just one of those things that just, boom, there it was. And, you know, a funny thing about that particular trip is I was really big into salt. I still am big into salt, and I collect salt wherever I go. And in Mexico, they had these little packages of salt in kind of like, they weren't Ziploc bags, but they were little plastic bags. And so I said to Belle, I said, oh, we got to take all this salt. Let's get a whole bunch of this and take it home with us. So, you know, I bought like 50 packets. So when we came to the border of Mexico, guess what they thought it was? Yeah, we weren't thinking very straight when we did that. Yeah, that was pretty outrageous.
So I know there was a lot of high strangeness in those years in Las Vegas, Mount Charleston, for one. Do you want to tell that story?
Oh, yes. I have probably mentioned this on another radio show, but on this particular day, Thurman, Belva, and myself went up to Mount Charleston Lodge, and we went in and sat down, and it's this huge fireplace in the middle of the room. And we love to eat, summer and winter, we love to go there. And we were sitting there, and a girl came and asked us, you know, what we wanted to drink. And I gave her my order, and I said, oh, I got to go to the bathroom. I get up and go in the bathroom and come back out. And the drink comes, and she puts down a little ticket. And the little ticket said December 5, I believe, 1968. Well, that was my birthday. But I thought, well, here we are in 80 or 81, and I'm going, I wonder what happened to their printer.
The printer.
their printer went wacky. And and then I looked up on the TV, and there was Nixon. And I'm going, what? And I'm looking around, and then I finished my drink, and then I have to go to the bathroom again. And when I go in the bathroom, it's decorated differently. And I come back out, and I go, oh, boy. I said, I don't know how to explain this. She said, what? I said, I want you to go to the bathroom and tell me what you see. And she had gone to the bathroom, too, so she had seen what it was. So she comes back out, and her eyes are really big. She says, oh, my God, what's happened here? The bathroom is decorated differently. She said, what has happened to us? I said, I don't know. I do not know what's happened to us. But we're in some kind of time warp. And I remember Thurman saying, well, why don't we just get up and go out of the building and then come back in? I said, okay. So we get outside to the, and Belva goes, let's get in the car and let's drive up the road. And I thought, well, okay. And we drive up the road and we see something and we note what it is. And it's a little park. It's a little bench and park and trees and things. Then we come back, and then we go back into the lodge, and then we go back into the bathroom, and now we're back into our time again. And I said, well, what about what we saw outside? So we get back in the car, and we go, and there's no park, and there's no bench, and there's nothing. Now we're really confused. We don't really know what's happened to us, because it's like, how do you explain that you're in a different time? And now you've got a little piece of paper stamp telling you that you're in 1968, and really it's, you know, either 80 or 81. I can't remember which year that was. So, you know, we kind of made a pact. Said, okay, we can't talk to this to anyone. This is our secret for a period of time. And, you know, that kind of bothered Belva off and on through the years. You know, we'd have different conversations about, you know, the Mount Charleston Lodge episode. But we came to understand that we were part of a gigantic galactic experiment, period. I settled down with it, she settled down with it, and we just said, okay, just one of those things moving right along now.
Yeah, you do about it.
Yeah. Now, I believe it was 1980 that Belva and I decided that we wanted to go to Egypt. And that was our first trip to Egypt. We took two trips to Egypt. So we went to Egypt, and it was with 250 metaphysicians. And, of course, Belva always had a way of finding people and making connections. And, of course, she found the mayor of Luxor, and the mayor of Giza. And he became part of our entourage. And we were under this tent one night having dinner. And I remember the mayor coming in on his prancing black horse inside the tent doing the dancing horse routine. And then when he got off the horse, he came over to us and he said, here's your passports. Hide them right now. And you need to get up and leave. And he looked at Belva and he said, don't ask me any questions, just do as I say. So we did. We got up and we didn't go out the front door. We actually rolled over to the side of the tent and rolled out from under the tent with our passports. What had happened is a man came in and said, okay, the people that brought you here, they did not pay us our money from last trip. They owe us $75,000. And we all have your passports, and you will not be able to leave the country until this bill is paid. So you need to call home and get money. Well, everybody freaked out. And we were outside the tent hearing this, and that's when I said, okay, it's time for us to get the hell out of Dodge. And so we grabbed a car, and we drove back into to Giza, because we were on the outside skirts. And at that point, we knew we had to separate ourselves from the group for a period of time, because we did not want to be in that particular energy of collecting $75,000 for the chance to get to go back home. So that was our first initial encounter with Egypt. On that trip, that's when I had that very, very strange experience with it. It started to rain without a cloud in the sky. And Belva had called me in the room. She said, oh, you got to come over here to this cafe. She said, I have met someone. He's the keeper of the keys of the pyramid, and you got to get over here. So I went over there, and I started talking to him, and that's when it started raining. And there wasn't a cloud in the sky. And I looked to my mood, and I said, when was the last time it rained? He said, oh, it hasn't rained, and this is not the rainy season. It will not rain. And in about 10 minutes, it started raining. And he looks at me and goes, "Who are you? Oh, my goodness, you've returned." He gets down on his hands and knees and starts doing this Allah thing. And I looked at Belva and I said, "What's going on?" He grabs my hand and we go flying up to the pyramid, and he grabs this, he doesn't grab a flashlight, he grabs a candle and takes me down to the inner chamber, at the bottom of the pyramid. And that's where I had some missing time, which is another story. So then when after this happened, Belva said, "Oh," she said, "I just know that Mahmood is, he is our connecting person to really make sure that everything that we came here to do will happen." And sure enough, there's a whole story that revolves around Mahmood and Belva, and I don't really have time to go into it. But her connection with Egypt was very strong, and she started having recall of different things that happened to her in other lifetimes. So when we came back to Las Vegas, we were changed somehow after that trip to Egypt. I mean, it really, a lot of things probably happened to us that we were not aware of at the time, that there was an evolutionary process that was being put in place. And I noticed that people that started coming into my life, they had kind of a theme, and the theme was being awake, being forward-thinking, being genius. That's when the Tesla kids started showing up. Everything was in forward motion for the evolutionary state of the planet. So about, let me think when it was. It was probably 1982, maybe. 82. I took a trip to Hot Springs, Arkansas, and I had several experiences there, many of which I've talked about on the radio show. When I left there, I got on the airplane to fly back to Colorado Springs, and that's kind of when a drop-by came in, and that's when I sat and actually wrote the 55 things to remember about quartz crystals, which are in the back of the book I wrote. And when I looked up, everybody was asleep on the airplane, and I kept thinking, gee, I hope the pilot's not asleep. And then when we landed, then everybody woke up, and there I was writing 55 things to remember about quartz crystal. When I got home to Cripple Creek, I called Belva and I said, "Boy," I said, "I had the wildest experience in Hot Springs, and I think I'm going to write something about quartz crystal." So the next day, I had a little brother typewriter. We didn't have computers then, so I just sat down, and all of a sudden, a drop by came in, and there went the crystal book. I wrote it, and Belva came out and edited it, and we gave it to our little publisher down in Colorado Springs, and it, all that took us about 2.5 weeks from start to finish. And then I never remembered writing it, and so I just never lectured on the book because I never could remember writing it to begin with.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So it was Belva that introduced you to Shirley MacLaine?
Yes. I think it was either the latter part of 82 or maybe the early part of 83. I'm not quite sure. I don't have my notes in front of me to see what year it was. But, well, several people had called me. Jeanette Browning, who worked for Shirley, had, and I had known her because she had worked for Robert Goulet. And she kept calling me, wanting to introduce me to Shirley. And there was all these phone calls and trying to get me to meet with Shirley. And, you know, I wasn't that interested. And Belva called me one day. I was in Ruidoso, New Mexico at the time. And she told me that Shirley had come to her shop to have her hair and fingernails done. And also that she was having headaches. And that Vernon and she had, you know, had worked on her, but she couldn't get the headaches to subside. So Belva told Shirley, she said, "I think I know of someone that you need to meet and someone that can really help you with this problem." So she called me to come, and at first I said, "No, I'm not coming." And then Shirley went on stage and the next day and had such a bad headache that she didn't know if she was going to be able to go on stage or not, and they went over before she went on to work on her. And she went on stage, she did her performance, she came back, she said, "You have just got to call that woman in Ruidoso. You just get her up here." And so Belva called me again. He said, "You just got to come." I said, "Okay." So I remember grabbing this veterinarian who did acupuncture. I grabbed him and I said, "You know, please come with me. Please come with me and be with me on this trip. I just have a feeling that I'm going to need your assistance." We get on the airplane in Albuquerque. We fly to Las Vegas. And I look up. Everybody's asleep on the plane. And I'm going, "Okay, what is this about?" I never really did find out. But when we got to Las Vegas, we went to the shop. And I remembered when I walked in the door, Shirley had on no makeup and big smile, and she goes, "Oh, there you are," and embraces me. And I said, "Okay, tell me what's going on with you." And she said, "Well, I have these headaches, and they just won't go away." And there was a table in there in her room, and I said, "Okay, lay down on the table." And I took my two hand crystals that I had taken with me to Cairo, Egypt, and had charged up there. And I also placed crystals in her hands. And I took a magnet, and I put underneath her head a magnet and these crystals. And I'm not really sure what all I did, but her headache went away. And so then she asked me if I would I would come to the show that night, and would I give her an additional treatment just before she went on. I said yes, and so I did that. So that's basically how I met Shirley. And then I worked with Shirley for the rest of the week. She had rented a house, and I went over to her house. I met Brett and Lee Elders at that time. They had joined up with Shirley and had actually taken her to Switzerland to meet Billy Myers, and so they were in her life at that time. So after that, she asked me if I would train her in ET matters. And I said, "Well, you know, I guess so." And I didn't really know it then, but she had had this experience down in Peru. And she was writing a book called Out on a Limb. And this experience in Peru, the book ended with her mentor telling her, "You know, I can't be with you any longer. There's another person that's coming into your life, and this person is going to finish your ET training." But I didn't know that at the time. But she knew. She had it in her head that I was the person that was going to take her further in her ET training. And, of course, when she asked me, of course, I obliged. I said, "Okay, we can do that." And so I had many adventures with Shirley. And every time I'd have an adventure with Shirley, I'd be calling Belva. I'd say, "Belva, listen to this. This is what happened to us today." And I have all of my high adventures with Shirley written chapter by chapter, and they're all sitting now in my bank vault. I haven't really decided when I'm going to release those particular adventures. But Belva was a witness to every one of them. Then there was the day that Shirley came up to Cripple Creek, and she was editing Out on a Limb. And she said to me, she said, "You know, my secretary is complaining about these letters that are coming in. And they know that I am, you know, metaphysical. I've done a couple of TV shows and radio shows, and everybody knows I'm writing this book." And she said, "My little secretary, she doesn't know what to think of some of the questions that people are asking." I said, "Well, when the book comes out, and it's coming out pretty soon," I said, "well, you need to think about hiring Belva to write your metaphysical letters." And so she did. She hired Belva to answer the mail. And sometimes, you know, we get 800 letters a day. Some days 300, some days 400. You never knew how many letters were going to be coming in. So after she did Out on a Limb, here came all those letters. So she had to hire two typists, And they would sit and open the mail and answer these letters, because people were saying, why am I here, and I'm waking up now. And because of Out on a Limb, I really attribute it to Shirley and the book that she wrote, because metaphysical bookstores just started popping up all over the country, all over the world. And it was about that time the crystal craze happened. And not only was the metaphysical stores opening, but they had a little sideline called Quartz Crystals and all these metaphysical stores. So it was kind of a craze that happened. All of it was just kind of working together, the crystal craze, the Out on a Limb book, the metaphysical information, the awakening of people, the starseeds that were coming out of the woodworks. It all just started happening.
I think I remember Belva saying that in the end there was something like 50,000 letters.
Actually, there were 65,000, I think.
65,000 letters that she answered personally on behalf of Shirley. So, I mean, Belva, even, you know, from behind the scenes and sometimes in front of the scenes, was really responsible for untold thousands and thousands of people awakening on the planet. And, you know, the ripple effect from that after 30 years, it's almost impossible to comprehend the influence that Belva Bloomer had on the metaphysical world.
Oh, I know. It's like everybody that hears our show, everybody that is attached to us in some way, it's a direct influence from Belva. And Belva, I think of her as a galactic treasure that, while she was here on the planet, gave us so much. But, you know, I feel like that Belva is going to be working from the other side in ways that we don't even know about yet. I just know. I know her soul. I know how she is revered upstairs. So I know that she's going to be helping us in so many ways, in so many ways. I'll miss her, but I'll also be reconnected with her, and I know it.
Well, Belva had yet another high adventure mission with your second trip to Egypt. You want to tell us about that?
Oh, yes. I was told that there was going to be a really gigantic experiment with the Pleiadians, and it was going to happen in November of 1983. And I was told to condition my body. I had to eat certain foods. I had to drink certain things. I had to get my body in some kind of physical shape, because I was going to be asked to do some things that was going to be really hard physically on my body. So, and I had to stay up at Cripple Creek to do it. I couldn't leave the mountain until I was totally put together the way they wanted me to be. And Shirley called me, and she wanted me to fly with her to Spain and then go on to Egypt. And I said, no, I really can't do that. I've got to stay here and prepare myself. Oh, wait a minute. Let me back up just for a second. I met her in Dallas, and I told her that I had this assignment with the Pleiadians, and I didn't know what was going to happen, and that they were going to come and put certain things in motion on the planet. And she looked at me and she said, well, can I go? I said, well, I guess. I said, I'm really, you know, I'm going to put the word out there. Whoever shows up, shows up. I'm not going to be in charge of a tour. I'm not a guru. I don't want people, you know, following me around about anything. I'll just say, this is happening. If you want to show up, show up. She said, oh, I definitely want to do that. Well, she canceled her big engagement, and then she was doing singing and dancing. And she had canceled her big engagement in Australia, and it cost her about $450,000 to cancel, but she did it. So anyway, back to, she calls me and she says, okay, come with me to Spain. I've been hired to do a commercial, and then we'll go to Egypt. I said, no, I can't leave the mountain right now. You'll just have to meet me there. Well, she was very disappointed, but that's the way it was. So I was told to hire a diver to go down in the Jeffrey mine and get these little tiny double terminated quartz crystals. They're called solution quartz, and they grow in water. They don't grow in the ground. They're very, very delicate. They're, some are as thin as a pin. Others are larger, and I'm sure a lot of people that are listening have received some of these Giza crystals that I'm talking about. So I got about, I guess the first time was about 40 pounds, and I had them relayed to Dallas to a friend of mine, and I told him, I said, you know, you're going to Ruidoso for Pleiadian lineup, and you take some out with you. And when you're through, give them to Charles, and he'll bring them to New York and hand them to me as we fly to Greece. So when Charles got to New York, he handed them to me. I looked at them, and I just freaked out. There was just nothing but mostly trash. I mean, it was just, I said, what in the world has happened? This is not what I ordered. So from New York, I called Belva, and I said, Belva, I said, we've got a problem. And I told her what it was. I said, can you call Carol? And Carol was our rich friend. And I said, call Carol, see if you can get some money to get these crystals. Hire the diver, go down and get more. And then you girls jump on an airplane and fly to Cairo, Egypt, and meet me there. I said, I'll be in Greece, though, for a few days before going to Cairo. And she says, gee, I don't know. She said, let me call Carol and see. Well, everything worked out great. She calls Carol. They get the crystals. They bring them. But she says on the phone to me, she says, you know, Shirley, I asked her if I could come on this trip, and she told me that she'd rather not see me there. She said, you need to stay home and answer the mail. And I said, don't worry about Shirley. I'll take care of Shirley. Don't worry about it. So 2 hours before we walk in to the pyramid, we were at the Mina house, and 2 hours before all this starts to happen, Belva walks in the front door, and Shirley and I are standing in the lobby, and I haven't told Shirley that Belva's coming. So when Belva walks in the door, Shirley goes, Belva, what are you doing here? And she said, well, so we told her what had happened, and so that was part of the story about Belva rescuing the Giza crystals at the 11th hour, bringing them to us. And we took these crystals into the Queen's Chamber, left them there. The Pleiadians fixed them, and they put energies in them that would certainly hold balancing beings between man and nature. And when I'd ask us, well, you know, how powerful are these crystals? And they'd say, well, you have nothing on your planet to measure them with, but they have 7 million times celestial power. And they have a mind of their own, and they will literally be activated at certain times and will go into motion. Some of them will disappear, and just some of them will jump around like jumping beans. And others will actually have direct voice into people's heads and say where they want to go. And it was after that that we brought them home. And, of course, I have so many stories about the Giza crystals, but the one that was so impressive was the one where people would wake up and hear, you need to get on an airplane and take the Giza crystals to Ayers Rock. And we had over 100 people to do this. So years later, when they found a hieroglyphic inside the pyramid over in Egypt somewhere that meant time travel, it matched the same hieroglyphic that was on top of Ayers Rock, time travel. So it made me wonder if in the future that the ETs weren't going to beam to those crystals and somehow levitate that rock. I know the experiment is still ongoing. I just don't know the end result of what this is.
Wow.
So I brought the crystals back home, and a lot of people knew that I had gone there, and I would, you know, people would say, send me some, I'll, you know, be a crystal light worker. I'd give them to Thurman, and he'd go to the post office, but what I didn't know is he'd open them up, and he'd keep some back. So when he died many years later, his daughter brought me this box, and I opened it, and there were about 10 pounds of these Giza crystals. Well, at first I got very upset. I said, oh, my assignment was not completed. The little booger, he took these out. Oh, what am I going to do? And then it dawned on me, wow, this is round two. There's other people that need these crystals now because they're time released, and I understand so much more about them now than I did then because of just the experiences that have happened with these Giza crystals. But it was Belva. It was Belva doing the 11th hour move, and the way was provided, and she showed up at the 11th hour just before we went into the pyramid. So, you know, I just love that story.
Well, it is amazing that, I mean, when you think the average person gets a call and says you've got 2 days to get this done and to show up and actually make the window, make it happen, it's the kind of magic that Belva was so famous for.
Yeah. And everybody that has a Giza crystal now, it's because of Belva. See, her work is still going on. Her work is still going on. Yeah.
Didn't Belva have a doctor in San Diego that had something to say about the Giza crystals?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, there were times when I did embarrass Belva, you know. She would kind of act like she didn't know me for at least 5 seconds. And this is one of those times. I went with her. She had a gynecologist in San Diego that she had all these years, and so we would fly from Cripple Creek to San Diego to see her doctor. And I went with her. And at that time, I was having a lot of problems with kidney stones. You know, I'd pee and bleed, and it was, you know, quite a problem. So after her examination, she says to the doctor, she says, you know, my friend is here. Would you do me a favor? Can she pee in a cup for you? Because she's passing these kidney stones. And we'd appreciate, you know, you looking under a microscope and telling us what you see. So she called me and she said, she's gonna. Can you go in and pee in this cup? And I said, yeah. So I went in, did it, and of course, you know, it was painful. And we waited, and this doctor comes out, and she's white as a ghost. She says, you better come in here. We went in there, and she said, she got her books out. She said, see this? This is what kidney stones supposed to look like. Here's what yours look like. When she put it up on the screen, Belva and I, we couldn't even talk. Our eyes got big. Our mouths flew open. And there was the Giza crystals. I was peeing the Giza crystals. I do not know how this happened. I still don't know to this day. The only thing I can say is I had a little bag of Gizas with me. And whenever I'd travel, I'd give them out to people. But what I'd noticed the next day is the bag was always full. It never was empty. And so I don't know how I was doing it or how that was being I don't know. That's just a big mystery to me to this day. But I know that the doctor, she wanted an explanation. And that's when we said, we just don't have one, and we got up and we just left. There was no way we were going to go into a conversation with this medical doctor about what we thought had happened.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ultimately moved Cripple Creek from Las Vegas.
Yes. Yeah, she after I moved up there, I invited her to come up, and she fell in love with the place. Just fell in love with the place. And actually, when I was looking for a house, I went and found the house that she actually moved to. I found it first. I was going to move there, but when she came up there, and I was in the process of closing the deal, she says, oh, no, give me this house. You won't like that. There was a train that would come right in front of the house and honk its loud noise. She says, you know, you're not going to be able to handle that noise. I said, you're right. So I went out and found this A-frame cabin instead. So I remember she paid $75,000 for Charles Frizzell's house. He was a very famous artist there. And she sold that house years later for $2.5 million. Yep. When gaming came to town. And that's another whole story about how she spent that money and how that Frank Sinatra's attorney showed up with a very big business deal and took her money. Oh boy, that was kind of a nightmare. Okay, but back to I'd like to talk about the Giza crystals a little bit with Belva and Shirley, because we had something happen that was talk about high strangeness. This was right at the top of the list. Shirley had come to my house, and I said, you know, I've got a feeling that maybe I should put you out on the deck, put mud all over you, and place these Giza crystals on your body. I just feel like that's something that I'd like to do. She says, okay, let's do that. And I said, well, how about a facial? Let's put mud on your face, and let's put these crystals on your face. And she said, oh, great. We did this at high noon, and I can't remember how long I left them on, but I remember when I took them off, and then she went in and showered, and she came out. I'll never forget the look on my face and then the look on her face. She said, I have no idea how this happened. She said, I looked in the mirror, and she said, I am like 15 or 20 years younger than when you put the mud on me. How did this happen? And I was going, oh my gosh, how did this happen? So I pick up the phone and I said, Belva, get out here. You're just not going to believe what's happened. So she gets out there and she goes, oh, do me. So we laid Belva down on the table, did the same thing, put the crystals on her, washed them off. Guess what? It aged her 20 years. Shirley and I stood there. We were so shocked. We thought, oh my God, what have we done? And the long and the short of it, we had to pay for Belva's facelift, body lift, everything, okay? It was like, we did it. We had to take care of it. But after that, I knew that I could never do that again. And it was explained to me that if your cells are in the up spiral, that there's a strong possibility of that, you know, happening the way it did for Shirley. But if your cells are in the down spiral, and at that time, Belva was not telling us that she had lymphoma. That was a secret, and she didn't tell us, and she was acting like, oh, yeah, everything's okay. It wasn't. And that's why she aged 20 years. So I had thoughts of, oh, good, we'll take these Gizas and we'll open a beauty place and we'll start a rejuvenation. And I just had all kinds of thoughts and ideas of what we were going to do with those Giza crystals. Nope, didn't happen. Not going to happen. Never going to do that again.
Right. And I would just add, though, that Belva did cure herself.
She did.
Without any of the traditional medical intervention.
Right.
She cured herself of cancer. She's her story about all the physical problems that she had through her life and the amazing healing. She was paralyzed as a child, and she fought back and got her body back. And then the story where she, do you want to tell about the story with her foot?
Oh, that's a very long, involved story. Yeah, it was practically sawed off, and then it was put back together, and she ended up dancing on it, you know. She was in the hospital for many, many months in Russellville, Arkansas. But she recovered, and it was just a miracle what happened with her foot. There is one little story that I would like to impart. It's one that never leaves me about Belva, and that is when I was doing my nightly visits aboard ship and coming back and doing all the things that I was getting involved in the ET world, I woke up one morning and they said, we want you to go over to your closet and pull out a jacket, put it on. I said, okay. Went over and put on this jacket, and I looked down, and it was like 3 inches too long. And they said, try another jacket. And I tried on the jacket I'd had on the day before. There it was, 3 inches too long. And I just did jacket after jacket I picked up the phone, I called Bev. I said, get out here. Get out here now. I mean, drop what you're doing. Get out here. And she came out, and I had all the jackets on the bed, and I just one by one showed her, and she just stood there going, what has happened to your arms? What's going on? I said, I don't know. And we grabbed them all up, and I remembered there were, I had a bottle of brandy, and I just grabbed it, and we got in the car, and she was driving, and I was sitting there drinking brandy, talking about, you know, what did they do to my arms, and we went down to the seamstress in Colorado Springs and walked in and asked her to shorten her. She said, oh, did you just come back from a rummage sale or garage sale? You know, couldn't tell her what had happened. So,
but, I mean, now, I mean, you know.
Now what, I know, yeah.
I mean, you've told me this, but why did they shorten your arms?
Yeah, the thing that gets me is if you were going to put a device in my arm, wouldn't you lengthen your arm? Doesn't that make sense? If you're going to put some additional in, it means, you know, we make room for. They shorten my arms in order to put two devices in my right and left arm that they would have that they could turn on whenever they wanted to. And I couldn't turn them on. They turned them on. And it was on certain things that I would be doing. You know, whether I would be touching a person, whether I'd be writing, whether I'd be on high assignment someplace, it was about these energies that they would turn on my arms. And for it to happen with Belva, what was part of it, because several years later, she called me and she said, guess what? They've done my arms. And they did her arms, just like me.
So she had to have all of her jackets.
And she had to have all her jackets, you know, taken up. Yeah.
My gosh. So the adventures never stop, and the repercussions from those are still rippling across the planet.
That's right. They are.
When I first met Belva, it was in 91, and I take that back, 92. And I went to meet her at the airport, and she stood out. I mean, I didn't have to guess which one was her, and she kind of reminded me of a cross between Phyllis Diller and Miss Kitty from Gunsmoke.
Oh yeah, that's a good analogy. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Dear sweet Belva, we know you're listening,
and her stories are back in our archives, especially the ones about Phoenicia and you know when she got very ill and left Colorado a few months ago and went to Utah. She went with the family that she'd had recall with from other lifetimes, and they're the ones that were holding her hand. In fact, Johnny was holding her hand when she passed away, and she had been his mother in Phoenicia. And, it was a very touching. I'm glad that she was with this family at the end of her life. Yeah, it means a lot to me. To know that she was surrounded by her loved ones from that lifetime.
And even within that family, Vernon had reincarnated with complete memory. I remember the story that she said where she had this, at the time, he was, after Vernon had passed, this child was 16 months old, and she went to visit. And she had a picture in her purse of a donkey named Jackie. Do you remember that story? And the picture I guess fell out of her purse, and this little 16-month-old that she didn't know at the time was Vernon picked up the picture and said, "Oh, this is my donkey Jackie, and now I'm little enough to ride him."
Yeah.
Just a miniature donkey.
Yeah, Belva said she said she couldn't even breathe when he said that. And he said other things. He kept talking about his life with her. And actually they came to Cripple Creek, and he pointed to the roof and said, "Boy, I'm sure glad I don't have to climb up there and work anymore."
Yeah.
You know, things like that, yeah.
Yeah. And the story where this small child was just squeezing her arm and saying, "Oh, Belba, I've looked everywhere for you."
Yeah.
How touching.
Yeah. And so Vernon now was incarnated in this kid named Jesse. And so she got to be with Vernon and Jesse when she died. Isn't that just amazing?
It is. It gives me chills just thinking about it.
Yeah. So they cremated Vernon, and he was in an urn, and so they cremated Belva, I believe, last Tuesday, and they have their ashes. And so I told them that I would like to get the Starseed family to help buy a tombstone for Vernon and Belva and keep it with the family there in Utah. That is my desire, to help put forth our energies to mark her place on the planet, although you can never mark her place on the planet. But
it's all over the planet.
It's all over the planet, but it's our way of saying thank you so much, Belva, for what you've done for us.
And starting 38 years ago, her actions, if you track down through these years, is the reason that we're on the radio tonight.
And, you know, she helped so many people with health issues. She was a homeopathic herbalist doctor of sorts, although she didn't have a degree. I mean, so many people are alive today because of Belva. She did a lot of work with Hannah Kroger and Ginger up in Boulder. I mean, that's a whole nother side of Belva that it just exploded after she came to Cripple Creek. She was doing a little bit of it when we were in Vegas, but nothing like what happened when she got to Cripple Creek. Another side of Belva happened. In fact, she was the one that actually brought gaming to Cripple Creek. It was because of her. She went to the legislature, to the governor. She brought gaming to Colorado, not just Cripple Creek. It's because of her that it happened.
Cripple Creek was just a teeny tiny little town with very few people and no commerce, and what they are today is because of Belva.
That's right.
I can't even begin to think how many people are what they are today or do what they do today because of Belva.
That's right.
She has been a light on the planet for more than one lifetime. And Belva, it has been an honor for myself to have known you. And I'm so grateful for the friendship that she had with you all those years, because ultimately, that's how come you and I met.
She was the catalyst for everything, you know, everything. After I arrived in Las Vegas, I tried to leave 2 or 3 different times. I didn't want to live there. And she just kept saying, "Oh, honey, you got to come back. Oh, honey, you got to." And I just kept saying, "Okay, I'll come back." And this went on for several months before I actually committed to moving there. And now that I look back on it to see how all this was prearranged before she and I ever left. Before she was ever born and came to the planet, she knew this plan. Before I was ever born, I knew this plan. That's how far I've been able to track it. It's like I can see us now aboard ship planning all this. Oh, yeah. Things are planned very far in advance, and I understand that now. If you had tried to have explained that to me in the late 70s or early 80s, I wouldn't have gotten it at all. But I get it now. I really get it. I can say honestly, she was my galactic handler. Okay? She was. And she probably still is. Okay?
Well, Belva's body may be gone, but her light remains. Her energy remains. I'm sure she's still working as hard as ever in service to others.
Right. And, you know, just before the last phone conversation I had with her, she said, you know, she said, I've got to do something with that Declaration of Independence. And under her bed, they found a copy of, an original copy of the Declaration of Independence, which is worth who knows how much money. Who knows how much money? I said, well, Belva, you've just got to find the right people and get on this right away. And that was one of the last conversations I had with her, her telling me about finding the Declaration of Independence, because her ancestry had actually signed it, George Taylor. Well, my ancestor had signed it too, Arthur Middleton. So it's like, oh my goodness, there it was again, our connection. Yeah.
There's no telling how many centuries.
Yeah.
Your lives have been interwoven.
Well, the time that she remembered me from Phoenicia, I was a belly dancer, and I also went down to the river and got these snails that were purple, and I would dye cloth purple. It's what she told me.
Huh.
Yeah.
No wonder that everything you own about is purple.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, I have a special song that I would like to sing in honor of Belva. I know that it's a song that she loved. I will be playing that here in just a minute if you'd like to make a final farewell to Belva.
Belva, wherever you are, know that I'm going to go ahead and complete our work that we started, and I know that you're going to be overseeing this from wherever you are. And I honor you, I treasure you, and I love you so much.
And now, a musical tribute to Belva.
To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, and to run where the brave dare not go. The unrightable wrong, and to love your unchaste from afar, to try when your arms are too weary, to reach the unreachable star. Without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for that heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will lie peaceful and calm when I'm laid to my rest, and the world will be better for this. That one soul scorned and covered with scars still strove with her last ounce of courage to reach
have been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.